My name is Charlie, and this is my story.
It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and I'm joined today in the studio with Steve Langhart and John Crum, both of whom are with the Merit Systems Protection Board, which might be the only time during the whole show that I use your full name. It's MSPB to those of us in the know. And Steve and I have become friends. I met him a couple of weeks ago at the FDR conference. I'm not so sure he thinks of me as his friend, but I think of him as my friend. And Steve's the executive director of MSPB, and we're very, very fortunate to be able to have Steve here with us today. John Crum tells me he's been on our show before. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Deborah.
And John is the Director of Office of Policy and Evaluation at MSPB. We do spend, like once a year, John, we get MSPB on, and we usually spend the show talking about the studies that come out of MSPB. I've never had the pleasure of having you on the show. It must have been one of my partners. So I feel fortunate to be able to finally get to meet you. John's been with MSPB since forever, right?
Plus some.
And so who better to be the director of the Office of Policy and Evaluation? And Steve, is this your first time on our show?
It is.
Okay, well, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's not mess up.
I try not to.
And I
do consider you a friend, Debbie.
Thank you.
I'm very fortunate to have your friendship.
Thank you. Steve's the executive director of MSPB, the Merit Systems Protection Board. And we're going to spend the next 50 minutes telling our listeners who you are, what you do, and what's new at MSPB. Because for those people who follow MSPB, which I certainly do as part of my law practice, it's very fresh. The website certainly has a fresh look, and it's to the extent you could make the merit system principles fresh and new and interactive, it certainly feels like it's happening over there. So, Steve, how long have you been with MSPB?
About 2 years.
And what is the job of the executive director?
The executive director is really the chief operating officer of the agency. I report directly to Chairman Susan Grubman, who's the head of the board, and I operate the day-to-day operations of the agency and do the long-term strategic planning.
So some of our listeners might not know exactly what MSPB, who you are, what you do. Can you give us a little background?
Sure. Well, our origins go back. We're actually a part of a U.S. history. Our origins go back to the Pendleton Act of 1883, which was passed by the Congress in response to a post-Civil War America, where largely government positions were handed out via political patronage. You either did something for a politician or you gave money and you got a federal job. In 1881, President Garfield was shot and killed by a office seeker for a federal position. He was denied that position.
A disgruntled office seeker,
absolutely, and went out and assassinated President Garfield. So the Congress decided that perhaps there's a better way to do business around town, and they passed the Pendleton Act in 1883, which created the Civil Service Commission. Which was in service. A lot of feds who've been around for a while certainly remember the Civil Service Commission. It was in service until 1979.
1883 to 1979.
Just a little under 90 years.
Yeah. Yep.
And the original Civil Service Commission, for those that remember, they were the rule maker, they were the system protector, and they're also the adjudicator of appeals from employees who wanted to challenge adverse actions against them. Because all of this was contained in one agency.
It kind of like, Steve, it reminded me, it was explained to me when I first began practicing law, federal personnel law, it was OPM and MSPB combined.
That's exactly what it was. And It created a certain amount of conflicts of interest and questions of whether the agency could perform all those functions within one set of walls. So in 1978, the Civil Service Reform Act was passed and actually broke apart the Civil Service Commission in 1979, created the Merit Systems Protection Board, also created the Office of Personnel Management, and the third agency that came out of that was the Federal Labor Relations Authority. And MSPB is designated as a successor to the commission, which is why we carry the year 1883 in our flag and our seal.
Wow. Could you be the oldest federal agency? Except maybe...
It's probably state and...
Or defense.
Treasury.
Treasury.
We're pretty close.
Treasury. So, okay, what... So, 1883, that's old. And tell us what are MSPB's functions?
Well, we're known mostly for our adjudication and dispute resolution services that we provide to employees and agencies for the appeals of adverse actions, retirement decisions, and other complaints. We also enforce our own decisions, and we also, the other large part of our mission is conducting objective merit studies of merit systems across the government. And these studies are aimed at supporting effective management that's merit-based and discourages prohibited personnel practices.
And that would be, John, that's your office.
That's correct.
And the way I like to sort of summarize for people who are new to the MSPB concept, because most federal employees, when they think of MSPB, they know that's the agency they want to go to. You know, if they got any kind of disciplinary action, everybody plays their own lawyer and decides, well, I'm going to MSPB. The reality is it has limited jurisdiction. You can only get there if you have a certain kind of action. It's more than 14 days suspension, 15 days or more, demotion, removal, retirement cases, and whistleblower reprisal cases. I always like to say you come through the back door of MSPB in a whistleblower reprisal case. But everybody, most people think of MSPB as the adjudicative function. You have administrative judges all over, staffed throughout the country in regional offices, and then you can appeal to the full board. But there's this other function at MSPB. It's the policy side of the house that a lot of people don't know about, John. And you've been there a while. But if you go on MSPB's website, the most recent studies in the last year, I think, are posted.
Actually, probably for the last 20 years.
For the last 20 years? Yeah. Well, the page I clicked on, it had back through December 2010.
If you go in, and browse our studies function on the webpage, you'll find our studies going back about 20 years.
And they're all posted up online?
And they're all on the website.
Approximately how often does the board come out with one of these studies?
Well, we generally publish about 5 to 6 per year on a variety of topics. We really try to hit the spectrum of merit principles. We believe as an agency we're about merit principles. Merit principles are about good management.
They're also about good government. If you go on the list, MSPB has the list online. If you go on the list and you read what the merit principles are, it's really about good democratic government. And Steve pointed out, like, certainly one of them is that you're going to run a government without patronage. And, you know, you have your list up there. But your office actually studies how it's playing out in the workplace.
That's correct. And in effect, I think that the reason the MSPB got the studies function was in sort of a balance of power interest, because OPM was going to be a political arm of the president. They were going to make policy from a political perspective. And the framers of the CSRA, I think, wanted an independent view of how that was operating, so that ultimately the policymakers, Congress, the White House, could reflect on what was done and see whether things were operating as, in fact, they were intended.
Mm-hmm. And what's the hottest one you have going right now?
What's hot
in merit system principles?
Well, I would say we actually have a number of hot ones. One of the themes that we think is just terribly important right now is the issue of how to manage and motivate a workforce at a time when people's, opinions of working for the government, they could feel under attack. They could, in fact, in some ways be demotivated.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the work that we've done is how to best manage people, not just in times of pressure, but in normal times. And we believe that there are things that people can do to motivate and encourage better performance at all times.
And have you issued a recent study on that?
Well, we've issued a number of them, starting back with a report we did a couple years ago on what we call employee engagement.
Right, I remember that one.
And what we showed there is that different levels of engagement affect organizational performance.
Yeah. You know, I think that's actually true wherever you work, whether you're inside or outside the government. If people feel, if they feel they're part of something and they're an important piece of it, I think people perform better.
Well, in fact, what we found is money is not a motivator for federal employees particularly. There are a lot of other things. They want to have a sense of accomplishment. They want to be part of something bigger. They want to, you know, fulfill their own careers and their own objectives. Part of that is to do things that for society.
Yeah, there's a whole breadth of other issues related to the studies that MSPB is conducting and is conducting that I want to get into. But we do need to take our first break. With me in the studio, Steve Lenkart and John Crum, both of the Merit Systems Protection Board. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hello, my federal friends. It's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. Geico now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. GEICO, the Government Employees Insurance Company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about GEICO's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. This is our MSPB show. I want to remind our listeners that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes can save you 15% on car insurance. For more information, go to GEICO's website, geico.com. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, give us a call toll-free. We're at 1-877-936-9333. Or if you want to remain anonymous and you don't feel like having airtime, send us your question or comment by email. Our email address is fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Before we took our break, John, and let me reintroduce you for listeners who might have just joined us, John Crum is the Director of Office of Policy and Evaluation at MSPB, where he spent his entire career. And I sort of feel an affinity for that, John, because like I was telling you, I spent my entire career practicing law at my law firm, and we really kind of do the same thing. We're both very much engaged in the concepts of federal personnel law. You were telling us about sort of a genre of studies that MSPB had been looking at for quite some time, good government, how to run a good government. And before we took our break, you were telling us about some recent studies.
I was speaking about employee engagement when we last talked about how that can affect performance of agencies. Once we had sort of identified that as a really important concept, a way to try to get at motivation, something that wasn't picked up when people just think about giving awards or just giving money or pay for performance. Actually, motivation is more than that.
Motivation is more than just pay.
Much more than pay. And so we then set out to figure out, well, what could we do to build engagement? And we were able to then identify in a subsequent study those sorts of behaviors, and they were primarily supervisory behaviors that influenced engagement. So that, for instance, if supervisors could influence the degree to which people could identify with their work by, in fact, pointing out to them the difference that they could make. how in fact they could accomplish something, how they were part of something bigger.
And when you say studies, how does your office go about conducting these studies?
Well,
surveys
is a prime vehicle. It's not our only vehicle. We also, of course, look at the research literature out there. We also can go and talk to agencies. We can talk to people who are involved in these issues to try to find out what they think, what they know, what their perspectives are.
So if you were to send out a survey, it's sent out to the federal workforce, right?
It is, usually to a small slice of it, because we want to be efficient. We don't want to we don't need to survey everyone in order to get a representative sample. Right now, we're out in the field with two surveys.
Well, I haven't gotten either one of them. I don't know, Steve, have you? Have they surveyed you yet?
No, I'm excluded.
Okay, there's a conflict.
I think I may be biased.
There's a conflict. So what's your office working on now?
Well, the two surveys we're working on now, one is on what we call fair and open competition. This is a big issue for federal employees.
For filling a position.
For filling a position,
yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah, it's always been a big issue. The federal view that many people feel that they go through the formality of the competition, but everybody knows who they're going to select.
This is a difficult issue. In fact, that gets into our second survey, which is what we call favoritism, which is, in fact, getting at the issue, are there inappropriate decisions being made, particularly in the selection round for people, that are not necessarily discrimination? Because, for instance, we've seen that discrimination concerns are not gone, but have declined over the years. But the issue of favoritism has not declined.
Mm. The first survey you were talking about, the open and fair competition, what's MSPB looking into?
Well, in effect, what are we doing? This is really going to personnelists, not to the general workforce, to find out how they are running, basically, the competitions, what they are doing in terms of advertising the jobs, how are people being considered and evaluated.
Mm.
What are the manager's input and agency's input into that process? And
that has to be, you know, in today's world, post the 2008 Great Recession, we've had people on our show talking about how to get a federal job, how to get a federal career, or how to move. You know, we have a career show, how to move up within the ranks of the federal government. And anecdotally, what I've heard is, and even dealing with HR offices in my own work, that, you know, if you used to get maybe 20 or 30 resumes for a job posting, you now get like 200, 300 resumes. And that, you know, it's not electronically scanned or reviewed. An actual person has to sort through all the resumes and quantify and qualify them. And so I think your survey comes at an interesting time to these personnelists, because their job, like, magnified the intensity of the job, magnified like 10 times over. And you have to wonder how do they look at and process and make those determinations, you know, even, you know, under these are very difficult times for them.
They are. And one of the things that we've been actually pointing out for years is that as a government, we're not using particularly good selection tools. We're not doing a particularly good job of evaluating candidates. It is very labor intensive. It is a very difficult process. There are a lot of competing factors that make that process very difficult. But as you say, the number of people applying for jobs has gone way up. Mm-hmm. It's gone way up in part because of the economy, but also because of things like USA Jobs and the Internet, where, mm-hmm. in fact, we do post these jobs. They are open to a larger number of people, and we get more candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And that does take time.
Mm-hmm. It takes time, and everybody wants a government job, and you have to wonder how these personnels, and particularly with budget cuts, how they're going to even, you know, they were doing more with what they had. Now you're going to ask them to do more with less and make the right decision, you know, hiring decisions. Those are tough decisions.
Well, not only are they tough, they're critical as far as we're concerned. The people, and from our perspective, this is one of the most important decisions a manager, supervisor can make. The people you hire are oftentimes the people you have for 20 years. Similarly, we don't use, for instance, the probationary period very well.
And you've done studies on that at MSPB.
We have. Very few people are removed during the probationary period. And in fact, it's sort of strange, but if we ask managers sometimes, well, you didn't take an action against this person, you didn't remove them during the probationary period, but would you hire them again? A significant portion said they would not.
So why aren't they using it? What'd you find?
Well, it's like taking any sort of personnel action. It's personal. They feel responsible for someone else's career. They feel for someone else's life, I should say. They feel responsible for making those critical decisions. They want to believe that they are both supported and confident that they're making the right one. So in the lieu of that, sometimes they opt not to make it.
Yeah, you know, I always feel if you created more bureaucratic process, I know this might sound like the opposite of what you would want to do, but if you created more bureaucratic process during the probationary period and you may, as opposed to just, you know, sending out a reminder maybe 30 days before the probationary period's over, which is what probably happens from the personnel shops
many,
to the manager.
Many times it does.
That you wouldn't have that reluctance if you required supervisors to do quarterly reports back to personnel with check boxes, you know, passing, not passing, you know, they get acclimated to the idea and they feel the bureaucratic pressure of, well, if you don't think they're passing, you know, at every quarter, then, you know, when we get to the end, you're sort of get acclimated to the idea that you're going to have to deal with this person. But there's no process.
I would say that's a subset of a bigger problem. The bigger problem is what we want supervisors to do. We haven't necessarily selected them very well, prepared them very well, support them very well for that.
And you've done studies on that, too.
And we've done studies on that. Right. We, in a sense, call that workforce stewardship. What is their primary role? Is it to get a job done today, or is it to, in fact, have responsibility for a workforce?
Well, and, you know, it's always been the perspective, the view of how people get promoted into a management position. And they were very good technically, so now we're going to have them manage. Whereas, you know, doing the job technically is not necessarily a good indicator. It's always been sort of a viewpoint, a perspective, a concern in managing the federal workforce. And then on the other hand, it's like, well, how else do they get career progression if they don't go into management positions? Because that's where the higher pay is. So clearly people are looking to get higher pay. And for all those issues, John, you know, we've certainly seen those studies come out of your office. And I do want to talk to you more about what's going on in your office. But I know that on the other side of the MSPB house, Steve, the adjudication side where most people personally connect up with MSPB. You've got lots of new stuff going on there. You've got a new board.
We have a new board. And we've had this board for about almost 2 years now. And we have two of, in addition to adjudication, our job isn't just to adjudicate. We see our job as also helping parties come to resolution if it's possible without going through the entire adjudication process through a formal hearing. And then to an order. Two programs that we use often are the mediation program and our settlement program. And they're very successful programs, are becoming more popular. And I'll just explain them very briefly. Our mediation program.
But in order to get into them, Steve, you have to have an appeal pending.
That's correct.
At MSPB.
Right. You file an appeal with us. It gets reviewed by an administrative judge. If a judge determines that it's the kind of case that qualifies for either mediation or settlement program, then that case will be offered to, that track will be offered to both parties. And if both parties agree to do that, then they'll go into either the mediation or the settlement program.
Okay. So I just wanted to make sure people understood that because so many people want access to the MSPB thinking that they can go there because they have some sort of personnel action dispute. But you have to rightfully be in front of the board before you can take advantage of these programs.
That's right. You have to file a case. The case is scrubbed for our jurisdiction. It's scrubbed for timeliness. Once it passes those tests, that it is an issue that's within our jurisdiction as an agency, then we go ahead and move you up to the next level. And if not all cases qualify for our mediation or settlement programs, but if
I feel mine did not. I feel I never got the invitation. I don't know what it was about my case. But the last few I had, I was not invited into the program. But I would have agreed with them that it was too contentious. I didn't think the parties could resolve it. That's really the whole thrust of both programs.
That's right.
Can the parties resolve it on their own without a third-party judge?
That's right. That's right. And there are some instances where that happens. If the judge believes that this particular case doesn't have to go all the way through the formal process, they will try to pull both parties out voluntarily to the side and try to get them one of these programs. Let's get them to talk to one another, talk of the issues outside of a formal setting of a hearing room, try to get to the bottom of what the issues are. We have mediators who are on staff and in-house, and they are attorneys who are trained and certified as mediators. We also have administrative judges who are willing to talk to appellants and talk to agencies and see if they're interested in coming to an agreement.
And the mediation program, I don't think we've given out MSPB's website. So it's mspb.gov. And if you go on to MSPB's website and you have to click on the at the top menu, you click on the appeals process. And in that, you'll find pages and pages of information about the mediation process. And one of the things I like, Steve, was that there was a chart where you did a comparison between, I don't know, I don't mean you personally, but the board has a comparison between what are the differences between mediation and adjudication? Adjudication meaning there's a judge, you filed your appeal, it's going to go to hearing, we're going to have witnesses, the judge is going to issue a decision, someone wins, someone loses.
That's right.
And on the other side is the mediation process. And there's this nice comparison for people to make a decision. But it has to be voluntary for both sides.
That's right.
And you can't make one side go if one party doesn't want to go. The board can't force it.
Right. There's no point. If one party has no interest in settling or in mediating, then why even bother going down that road?
Right.
Both are voluntary programs, and they're voluntary so that if both parties agree to go into it, they're more motivated to settle. They both see some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. And possibly a meeting point where they can both agree on.
Yeah. Now, the statistic that's on the website for the number of cases that go into mediation and settle in mediation is rather remarkable. It's 50% reports on the MSPB website. And then it says that for the 50% who don't settle but go to adjudication, that another 10% will settle before hearing just on their own. So that's a pretty high settlement rate.
It is. It is a high settlement rate. Within the program, of those cases that go into one of the two programs, we have about 62% of the cases actually go to some kind of settlement.
Yeah, which, it's a good workload management tool also.
Absolutely.
And, of course, for the parties to be able to reach an agreement jointly as opposed to having a decision imposed, it's a really great tool. And wasn't always available. So it's a rather new program.
It's a money saver as well.
Yeah.
For both agency, for appellant, for us.
Yeah, for everybody. There's an efficiency, you know.
Right.
We do need to take our mid-show break. There's more news on the adjudication side of the house at MSPB that I want to speak with Steve about. But we need to take our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, it's the Geico Gecko. Now, as a federal employee, you're probably one for a smart presentation, so I've put together some charts and graphs here. There you go. That will help illustrate the money you could save by switching to Geico. First thing you'll notice is that Geico now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. Now, this is big news. But that shouldn't come as any surprise from a car insurance company that has been serving government employees since 1936. And as you can see on this graph here, it's probably why we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. Yeah, no, I do actually realise you can't see these, but trust me, they're rather impressive. Especially the 97% customer satisfaction rate. And when you consider it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more, well, all you GS7 employees or above should just contact Geico. Tell them, Mike.
Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey, and the Gecko said it best. Most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above, could get a discount on their car insurance. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and this is our MSPB show, the Merit Systems Protection Board. With me today is Steve Lenkart. He's the executive director at MSPB, and John Crum, who's the director of Office of Policy and Evaluation. And I failed to mention when we were going over some of the more recent studies that MSPB has issued out of John's office that they're all online. Office of Policy and Evaluation has its own set of pages on MSPB's website. You can go to MSPB's homepage and easily find John's office. And the studies are all there, very accessible, and easy to read, I might add, John.
Well, we strive for that.
Yeah, easy to read, as opposed to feeling like you're reading something that came out of a think tank, you know, and it's somebody's thesis.
Well, hopefully it's still thoughtful, but...
Right, as opposed to reading somebody's thesis. Steve, before the break, we were talking about some of the new projects at MSPB, and we talked about the mediation program, which is relatively new. It's a few years old, but it's very solidified, and now you're starting to see some really good numbers from it. And you did mention that you have a rather new board, the three-member presidentially appointed board, and I know they've brought some other changes with them. For somebody who practices regularly there, I've noticed the changes, but tell us some of the more exciting ones. Because I'm sure there's plenty that the rank and file that means something to the actual employees of the agency. But for people who the agency served by, what else would they notice is new?
Well, when Chairman Grumman came in November of 2009, in her prior experience, she was on the other side of the bench where you sit. And so she brings with her that credibility and level of experience of being a user, a customer of MSPB. So... one of her big initiatives was transparency in how we operate, kind of pulling the curtain away from our front door, letting people look into our agency, see how we operate, see how we think, and get into the mind of the board a little bit more than they have in the past. One of the probably the most public and noticed ways that we've done this is we've had two oral arguments over cases within the past year. These particular cases had a widespread relevance or impact across the government. And it's those kinds of cases that we look for to invite the public in to participate in those cases, to hear oral arguments, to file amicus briefs, and try to influence these large cases that may actually have an effect on them, even though they're not directly involved as a party themselves.
Yeah, and I spoke about those cases 2 years running now at FDR, and I just spoke about them. Just a few weeks ago when we were at FDR in Palm Springs, and I said, you know, well, we need more. What else will I do? I mean, I have to come back and be able to talk about some of these very interesting legal issues that have popped to the surface. And you can go on MSPB's website and read about those cases that were argued last September.
Yes.
And what I like to always say to just the general public, people who are users of MSPB, is I've been practicing over 20 years, and MSPB has authority to do oral argument.
We do.
And in 20 years, they've never exercised it.
That's right.
So, you know, what a fresh way of doing business. And what was interesting about both cases was the potential for government-wide impact and impact on federal, all kinds of federal employees across the executive branch, and to open it up beyond the actual two parties and let and hear from other people to see, you know, are we getting thoughts and information and analysis from everybody who could be a stakeholder, just like federal courts do. You know, they have argument, they have oral argument, it's open to the public. Anybody can write an amicus brief. And so I thought, what a fresh use of the authority the board already had. And so for practitioners, and I'm sure for federal employee unions, you know, they welcomed the opportunity to be able to be heard.
Yeah, agencies alike. We had a great response through both oral arguments. We had a number of organizations file amicus briefs, and they range from practitioner groups, to federal employment groups, academia, and agencies themselves. What's nice about the oral arguments is it gives the public a chance to hear the arguments, to hear the questions the board members are asking. And before I forget, we have a webpage dedicated to the oral arguments that's active that you can go on anytime. You can download the audio feeds, the transcripts, I believe there's a video feed as well. No, not a video, just audio. And can listen to the cases at any time.
And my sense is that this isn't a one-time event, that to the extent there's another case that presents itself with an issue that has government-wide impact on agencies and federal employees, that this board would likely choose oral argument again. I didn't get the sense from how it was presented that it was one time, this case only.
Not at all, no. And we're always conscious of those cases that come across that may have an interest that way, that may have an impact like that. And we also have been inviting more amicus briefs to cases as well. We put notices in the Federal Register, and those notices are available on our website. If you go under our public affairs section, you can see where all the current notices are for all of the amicus briefs.
And again, another, it certainly was always available, a tool always available to the board, but never used. I can't remember any instance where I saw someone attempt to file an amicus brief. For our listeners who might not know what that means, it's you're not an actual party to the litigation, but you represent a group of employees, a group of agencies, public officials, policy thinkers who might have an analysis that would shed light for the adjudicators. And you file a brief as a friend of the court. It's really what it means. It's a That's friend right. of the court. But a lot of people that I speak to in the community welcome the opportunity. I think even agencies, even though it's new, and I think anything new like that makes agencies unsettled, I think they welcome the opportunity to be heard on other cases that might affect them.
Yeah, we have. And we've had agencies file amicus briefs as well. We've probably had about a half dozen cases over the past year and a half where we put notices out for amicus, and we've had a pretty good response.
Yeah. So that's one of John has something.
I was going to say, we're in a similar transparent vein. We also had a sunshine meeting for our research agenda setting process for the first time. We had over 1,000 ideas come in for study topics. We distilled them down and had an open meeting where different parties come in and tell us about what they thought we should be studying.
Yeah, and I wonder to what extent, John, those ideas were different than if it had been homegrown, right, inside the agency.
They're certainly broader.
Yeah.
And they gave us a better perspective to judge what we should be working on. Just certainly what our constituency is interested in is something that is important to us.
Yeah.
It's same on the legal side as it is on the study side. And I just wanted to point out that this transparency is throughout the agency.
And I've heard the chairman speak about what her vision is for the board. I've heard her speak a couple of times. Transparency is certainly, I'd say, her overall arching way of describing what she wants to bring to the board. What else, Steve, is new over there?
Well, we're always looking for ways to reach out to the federal community, to appellant practitioners, agency representatives, and just the general public on ways to educate them on what it is the MSPB does and how the MSPB may or may not fit into an issue going on in their lives. We have on our website right now, we have a video that is basically, it's an introduction to the appeals process for MSPB. It's slightly dated. It is low budget, but it's still very accurate.
What's it, Steve at his desk filling out paper?
It was John Crum.
Unfortunately, it was me.
It was John at his desk filling out paperwork?
That's what I do most of the time, yes.
Right, but no, still it's – well, I thought the website – I noticed that the website – since the last time and getting ready for the show, I went on your website, and I don't think I've been on your website for about 10 months. And I thought it had been significantly transformed. It's so much more user friendly. It's simplified, but yet there's a lot more information. And if you look at how MSPB did business 10 years ago, it's transformed. I mean, all your forms are up there. You have the electronic filing. You have a video now to show people what the appeals process is like.
That's right. That's right. We've taken transparency. We've taken technology, we've taken user-friendly formats, and we've combined them into our website. We've completely redesigned our website. We have streamlined access with RSS feeds that are available for decisions, case reports, our studies. We have a merit of issues of merit newsletter that you can punch on by hitting the RSS feed button and for our press releases and have those sent directly to you. We also were on Twitter. We have two feeds for Twitter. One is a main feed and one is a backup feed for system outages and scheduled maintenances. We have two listservs that you can sign up for. One listserv is for MSPB studies and the other one is for decisions. So if you sign up for both of those listservs, when we publish a study, we'll send it directly to you. When we publish a decision, we'll send it directly to you.
Yeah, much more interactive and user-friendly. And, you know, one of the things I meant to do but I didn't was read your annual report, because I like to always have the number in my brain of how many appeals you get filed a year. I think it hovers between 8 and 10 or 12,000.
That's about right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. And it sort of depends upon what's happening in the government. If the government has to go through a RIF, you'll see a lot more appeals. That number will jump for you guys. But thousands of people are pro se, and the process is very legalistic. And what I've noticed when I go on the website is, you know, it used to be, I used to say to people, if you weren't a lawyer, it was very hard to succeed on your own there, to get the filings done right. And now, you might be able to do it. You might be able to go through the system. Of course, the judges are very helpful. You might be able to get through the system and the process because it's all there online, and it really is a very nice, simplified, step-by-step way of going through the appeal process and explaining, you know, what will happen to your case as it moves through the system. We are going to wrap up our MSPB show momentarily, but we need to take the last break of our show. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
It's the Geico Gecko with a little hello to all you federal employees. Now, in government, there are people on all points of the political spectrum. But there is one thing that everyone agrees on. Saving money is good. Which brings me to the big news. GEICO now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. It don't matter if you're a Democrat or an aristocrat, left wing, right wing or a chicken wing. If you're a federal employee GS7 or above, you could be saving a lot of money on your car insurance by switching to GEICO. So no matter if you're blue or red or in my case green. If you're a federal employee, GS7 or above, contact GEICO and see how much you could save. Isn't that right, Mike?
Exactly right, my little green friend. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. And like the Gecko said, discounts are available for most federal employees, GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. You're in the last session or section of our show with the folks from the Merit Systems Protection Board. We have with us two people from the board today. We have their executive director, Steve Lankart. We spent some time talking with Steve in our last session about what's new at the board, more of the efforts to become more transparent. And we have John Crum with us. John joins us regularly, hopefully once a year, to talk about the studies that come out of MSPB. He is the director of the Office of Policy and Evaluation. And I know, John, there's a few coming out that you want to alert our listeners to and maybe share some information from.
Absolutely. Just next week, we expect to issue a report on prohibitive personnel practices.
These PPPs.
PPPs, the flip side of the merit principles. Merit principles are what we should be doing. PPPs are what we should avoid at all costs.
Right. I like that. Two sides of the coin.
They really are. What we found is we've actually been tracking the sort of perceptions of PPPs for the last 20, 25 years. And for the most part, they're going down. It is a success story. And I say for the most part, there are some exceptions. And those exceptions primarily are in the area we talked about earlier, mm-hmm, of selections for jobs. Mm-hmm. There are still concerns about the fairness of that process. But overall, other perception of PPPs have declined quite dramatically.
Wow.
That doesn't mean, however, they've been eliminated. And that's sort of the other point of the study that will be coming out, is that even small numbers of PPPs can have a sort of disproportionate negative effect on the workforce.
Yeah. One of my favorite, I don't mean it figuratively, one of my favorite prohibited personnel practices, I think one of the ones that is most interesting as it plays out in the workplace is nepotism. Because it's, you know, when you think of what the prohibited personnel practice is, the favorite, like, mm-hmm, the number one is whistleblower reprisal. But nepotism, you know, whistleblower reprisal could be known only to the person who feels victimized. Whereas nepotism, you know, once people find out that was John's son that was hired, it has an enormous ripple effect.
A great example of how the effect can be very disproportionate to a single action.
Yeah. And I think nepotism is one of those that really, it's like a wave that goes out. And for clients who come in on the issue of nepotism, they're either accused of it or they're, you know, they feel they were a victim of it because they didn't get a job through nepotism. You know, for federal employees, I don't think they really understand or they don't appreciate that in a private held business. Well, it, of course, can, it's what's called a family business. You know, welcome to nepotism. But in the federal system, it's the absolute contradiction to what Steve was talking about at the very beginning, you know, political patronage. Patronage of any kind is viewed as the wrong way to run a democratic, bureaucratic system. And nepotism, I've seen a bunch of cases recently where it's alleged, and it's really a powerful effect on the workforce.
Well, one of the things that we found, we talked about the concept of engagement earlier, is that, in fact, when people observe PPPs, levels of engagement go down. So we can work very hard to build up engagement, and we talk about how to do that, but it's easy to undermine that through things that take away perceptions of integrity in the system.
And your study on PPPs is issued or about to be issued?
It should be issued next week.
Next week, absent the hurricane, right?
It will still go out on the website.
Right, the earthquake and the hurricane. You also have telework.
Telework's coming up probably a month or two out. It's interesting study, I think, in the sense that what we found, which is not really surprising, is that there are real benefits to telework. Telework that is particularly critical at this time for the workforce. And what I mean is, in telework, in effect, we give employees the right to do something, to get something, a personal benefit, a benefit that makes their life easier, basically. Mm-hmm. But in return, we get something back. Mm-hmm. What we get back is the increased ability to recruit and retain people, which is very powerful in today's world. I mean, if in fact we're going to have to either downsize or we have, you know, people concerned about the attacks on federal workers, you know, is that going to make people leave? Well, we can offer something that a lot of places don't. Offer us things that will both lead to recruitment and retention benefits.
And does your study measure? Is it measuring the success of telework?
Well, it does in a sense. What we say is, well, there are these real benefits to work in organization, and they can come, if done well,
yeah,
without a loss of productivity. And
yeah,
that's the real key, that people can make informed, good decisions about who should telework and when they should telework, and thereby give the agencies and organizations greater flexibility. And greater ability really to manage what they do.
Yeah.
But they have to be done well.
They have to be done well. And, you know, OPM for years has been promoting telework on the one hand, and on the other hand, struggling with getting a set of, you know, rules and guidance in for agencies to manage a telework program where you know your employees are actually working the hours they're supposed to work and producing as if they were equally producing as if they, you know, were in the office.
But our results certainly indicated that it can be done. The issue is really, again, back to, again, themes that we've talked about, preparing managers to operate in both environments. They really are not doing something different, but they have to think about things differently.
Hmm.
They have to think about things in terms of, you know, what are the employees supposed to accomplish? Are they, in fact, getting that done? And what are the issues that might ensue?
Yeah. You know, and I think it's like anything new that you introduce to the workplace, some of the problems sort of get worked out through experience. It's like, okay, well, now that was that kink we didn't anticipate, and now we've seen it, and now we have to deal with it.
Well, and there's also sort of resistance to change. Now, some of that resistance is based upon experiences that may have colored them against it. On the other hand, we're seeing that there are ways to make the program work.
And your telework study is still underway?
It's in the final writing stages now.
Okay, and so we should be seeing that
in a couple months.
And if you sign up for the feed that Steve talked about, you can choose to automatically have it sent to you?
Right. Our listservs will send the studies directly to you as well as our decisions. Two separate listservs, but they're there for you.
So, John, anything else coming out of your office that we should know about in the last few minutes of our show?
Well,
these are your last few minutes.
Our last few minutes.
For the hurricane.
We also will be issuing, we're working on a report now, looking in more depth at how to motivate people, more explaining the issue of engagement from a real nuts and bolts fashion.
A user's guide.
Sort of a user's guide.
Yeah.
That's a little farther off, but we're working on that, as well as, again, I mentioned like the fair and open competition study, the favoritism study. We've also done a study of workplace violence, something that really has not been looked at in the federal government.
Yeah, at least for a long time. OPM had something up that was years and years and years ago. You sort of hope those kinds of things really don't happen. Maybe that's why people don't study it, because they're hoping, you know, violence in the workplace is just really can be very frightening. In the last few minutes of our show, Steve, I know that there's a couple other new things happening at your level at MSPB or an operations level that you wanted to talk about. One of them is the FOIA, new FOIA tracking system.
Right, that's due out at the end of September. It's big news for us. We only get about 400 FOIA requests a year, but we're only an agency of 200 people, so that's quite a bit for us. And we're a bare bones agency, so we have one person working part time on it. And as a matter of fact, that person's filling in for the person who retired a while ago. So with this new system is coming in, which is good news for folks who have filed FOIA requests with us. It's going to help them file directly right on our website. They'll be able to track the request, and they'll be able to get the results back all in one kind of a one-stop shop.
And I know you're doing some outreach. MSPB has some outreach it's doing. It did an EEO. It did training to EEO practitioners. Just what was it, 2 months ago?
That's right, yeah, about a month and a half ago. Yeah, and we do quite a bit of training out there. Some of our most popular topics are agency representatives who are interested in penalties, more on the lines of how do you make sure that penalties given by supervisors are evenly handed throughout an agency or throughout a department, which is very difficult to do when you're working with different supervisors in different areas. A lot of information about whistleblowers. What is a whistleblower? What is the standard of proof?
That is the $64,000 question. The Federal Circuit has made it so hard to know if you're legally a whistleblower. Federal employees think that they make a grand announcement, about someone doing something wrong, and they then say in their email or their announcement, they actually utter the words, and I'm invoking the protections of the Whistleblower Protection Act, and they think that that somehow really magically makes them covered and protected, and couldn't be farther from the truth. So I'm sort of glad to hear that MSPB is actually explaining to people how to do it so that you're legally protected.
That's right, and we'll come out, we'll talk to agency representatives, we'll talk to employee groups, we'll talk to unions. Whoever wants us to come out and speak, we'll have an administrative judge come out and speak to you. We do it all the time, and we'd like to do more of it.
Wow. That is definitely new at the board. I also read that you're posting on your website what I, in my profession, we call the non-precedential decisions. They're non-precedential, meaning you can't cite them. But in the effort of transparency, you can't cite to them as authority. But I think what's interesting is, that in the effort of transparency, look, they might not be legal authority, but it'll give you a feel for how we're thinking. So that's up on your web also.
Right. And we're looking forward to that. That should be hitting in the next couple of months. And it's good for the general research for the public. They're instructional. They're useful for providing insight into how the board is thinking. Gives general impressions how the board opinion came up to the opinion on a particular case.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting method of being more transparent. You know, look, it's not actual authority, but let me give you a feel for how we think about things. We do have to sort of end our show now. John, I want to thank you for being on our show again. We look forward to your study. Steve, I hope you'll come back in a year and tell us what else is new and fresh over there. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you,
Debbie.
Debbie.